The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Today, we have Jerry Kasar, chairman of the Conservative Party in New York. Jerry, welcome back. And first of all, I want to ask you this. Why are you a conservative?
Well, I mean, I've been a conservative really since I first enrolled to vote. I believe in the principles of less government. I believe that there is a role for government, but that's just primarily, at least domestically, you know, to keep our lives safe, to, you know, build bridges or roads. And, you know, in foreign policy, certainly there is an enormous role there. But generally speaking, I support lesser government. And my social issue values really point to the right. So whether it involve government or not government, my just whole view on social issues would be considered, you know, to the right of center.
So, Jerry, give me an example of a social issue which forces you to the right.
Well, I wouldn't say force. I'm pro-life.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say forces it to me. But I would say that would be, I think, the most obvious example. But I suppose even like when it comes to social programs, I do believe in a safety net. But I strongly believe that there needs to be, and I'll put it in quotes, a buy-in from the individuals who are benefiting from what could necessarily be a safety net that they need. That you know, government is not just creating a feather bed. That they're creating a mechanism for the person to dig their way out, to have a permanent job, to have housing that they can purchase at some point. So I have those idiosyncrasies within my thought process. And that kind of moves me to the right.
So what makes you become the head guy in the Conservative Party, if you're following me? In other words...
Yeah, I'm the last man standing. No, no.
Yeah.
No, I'm an activist. You know, I'm not just a political activist. I'm a civic activist, too. I've done many different things, from being on a hospital board to chairing civic associations, and I'm still on boards here. So, you know, my activism, and where I did also work for the state legislature for many years, which I considered part of my activism, just drawed me to politics. And I like to think I'm competent. I believe other people think I'm competent. And with that sort of competency, I was able to move up. And, you know, frankly, a lot of people don't want to be the state chairman. It's a lot of hours. I don't get paid, frankly. You know, I volunteer for this. And for me, it was a way to succeed in playing what I consider the ultimate role, for me anyways, in state politics. This is my last stop along the route, and I'm going to do as good a job as I can.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 62.
Well, that's coming to an 80-year-old me. That seems like almost diaper stage.
So, well, I'm not planning to retire in the near future either. So hopefully.
And what is your day job?
I am retired. I'm a retired state employee. But I'm saying to you, I'm not really planning to retire as state chairman. So my day job is this, but it's not a paying job.
So in the news as we speak now, on the federal level, but it certainly exists on the state level also, is an accusation that staff members in the legislature are campaigning for their bosses, despite the fact that on the federal level, at least you have a Hatch Act and you have similar things on the state level. So the question then is, are you shocked to hear this?
Well, I think legislative employees on a federal level and certainly on a state level are on their own time allowed, and I personally would, you know, advocate on their own time that they exercise their freedoms there. But to your point, I'm not totally shocked if we hear it's expanded beyond that in an inappropriate manner, because basically, you really can get into a situation where you are so concerned about your, you know, the person you're working for, your employer, that you, you know, you could potentially cross the line. I do think, though, that that line can be a little fuzzy. I mean, if you so obviously cross the line, well, then you should have a problem. But there is a little fuzziness there between, I think, what is, you know, I'm talking about outside the legislature. So legislatures do allow it, but it has to absolutely, absolutely be on your own time. For the other individuals, the Hatch Act is a little less restrictive now than it used to be, but there's still a line, and you got to be very, very careful.
So the rule of law means something to you.
Yeah.
I say that because I'm going to try to trap you on Donald Trump.
Oh, I appreciate it.
But if we have laws and we don't adhere to them, and that's why I find this last subject we're discussing to be so difficult for me. Because if we have a Hatch Act and you have a state legislature, and I remember when a whole bunch of legislators were almost indicted by Robert Morgenthau. I think they were indicted, in fact.
You know, like during the Ornstein period back then?
That's right.
What I think you're talking about, yeah.
And what happened was that all the other leaders came forward and said, you can't do this to him because we do it too. So doesn't that create disrespect for the law?
Well, law should be equally applied to everybody, obviously. I remember back then, I was just kind of like, I actually was working for the legislature back then, but I was, you know, I might have been just a year out of college or something. I don't know. What I remember at the time was that there was initially confusion over what were the rules. I mean, I do think that I do think that got quickly clarified, frankly. And then I do believe that despite some of the legislative leaders circling the wagons, they were also instructing staffs and supervisors to be very, very clear that none of this could be conducted. You know, there were lines, and none of this could be conducted during one's workday. So I do remember everything you said is true, but I also remember there was an internal reaction. I mean, back then, God knows, maybe Emory was, I don't even remember anymore, but in the assembly. But I am saying to you, I do recall supervisory staff essentially going in and indicating that, no, you cannot be using the phone to do a political call. You cannot be, there were no computers back then, but you cannot be bringing people into the office that might be politically oriented for a meeting. It has to be after your work hours. And I have no problem with that, just so you know.
Yeah.
It needs to be. I mean, I believe that you should not be losing your constitutional rights because you work for the government to be able to advocate for your views. But it has to be off the taxpayer dollar.
Sure. Let's get to the news of the day. First, what's your reaction about the news that a federal judge has rejected former President Donald Trump's effort to block the January 6 investigators from accessing White House records? And she said, the judge, who I have great respect for, Tanya Chutkan, that presidents are not kings and plaintiff is not president. Now, you're a conservative, I'm assuming. But what do you make of a judge really giving them a whack across the jaw?
I saw the headlines, of course, and I've heard it on the news. I haven't actually read the I haven't read the decision. I mean, I think there is a polarization and a politicization that has been going on relating to everything concerning January 6th, which, you know, I mean, as an individual and a conservative leader, I totally denounce any person who walked within that Capitol building. That was just too obviously a violation of the law, frankly, not to mention the violence that took place and the disruptions to government and the view of the country nationally. But at the same time, I do think that there has been a bit of a witch hunt concerning President Trump relating to January 6th. And as far as the court decision is concerned, it doesn't really surprise me. I'm finding more and more that on a federal level, court decisions on political issues, tend to draw back to the appointing authority. Not always, because you see some things in the U.S. Supreme Court where certain votes swing back and forth, but I'm seeing more and more politicization with judges that have lifetime terms, so you would think that they might not act that way, but they do.
I agree with you.
So I'm going
to. I agree with you. I think and Trump had so many appointments to the federal courts, for example.
Yes.
Made especially.
No, I agree.
Especially out of that what you're saying does do great harm to our judicial system, I think. Because if people will get cynical and say, he's a Trump judge or he's a this judge or that judge or a Biden judge.
And, it's not universal. It doesn't always work that way. Yeah. And thank God most of the things that come up before our courts are much drier and these decisions can be worked out through the rule of law. But politics is a very funny thing when it enters the courtroom, whether it be on a state level concerning petitions or a local level concerning petitions or on a federal level. And the Democrats have enjoyed this as much as sometimes the Republicans do.
You're a conservative. What's the difference between you and a Republican?
So basically, I think it does come down a little bit to our willingness to put front and center some social issues. And there's one other thing which I like to remind people of. You really don't have a left wing in the conservative party. Now, maybe there is less of a left in the left side of the Republican Party than there might have been, say, when Javits was around or Congressman Green or Goodman in the state Senate. But, the conservative party runs the gamut from center-right to right, and or the conservative movement, I should say. So I think that's part of it. And the social issue agenda. The GOP, for example, would be pro-life and through their planks, and I use that just again as an example, but we would be a little more willing to be vocal on it. That to me would be the differences.
Uh-huh. And how are you doing in terms of the electoral process? I mean, is the Conservative Party making any headway at all?
So here's the story on that. The Board of Elections just came out with its new numbers, and we have 154,000 active members according to the Board of Elections. We didn't change. It really didn't change at all. The Democratic Party and Republican parties both went down, but not by enormous numbers. Don't misunderstand me. But they did go down. Working Families Party went up a little bit, a little more. They went up a little bit, frankly. And blanks went up a little bit, too. So right now, I would say, as far as people joining the party, we're very stable. I'd like to see increases. But frankly, nobody saw increases. We were just very steady. Also, our vote, and here's the important point, we definitely led the charge with enormous help from Nick Langworthy in the Republican Party, who made this tour of the state last week on those proposals. I mean, we spent money identifying ourselves with the proposals, because clearly you have to say who paid for it. So we identified ourselves very clearly with those proposals, and even in the city of New York, before the papers counted, 40% of the people in the city of New York did turn the ballot over, voted no on those proposals, which was consistent with what the party was suggesting. I feel that was a reaffirmation of the Conservative Party's role in state politics. I would equate it to the mouse that roared, but many people in the Democratic Party didn't even think there was a mouse out there. And now they've got to look at the fact that we did roar, and might have sent a message that what the New York State Legislature does, the Democrats with their votes, is not really reflective of what the people in the state think, and possibly they are a little bit out of touch.
Well, I've often spoken of this on the air, so I want to pardon myself with all the listeners. But I had a guy when I grew up at 96th Street in Manhattan, and he was Harry the Doorman and a great sage. He went to Pimlico from Manhattan every weekend, but he always said, just say no. Now, I read Proposition 1. I'm a political scientist. I was a full professor for 40 years. I have honorary degrees. I'm just saying this, and I couldn't understand Proposition 1. Why does a legislature, in your opinion, draft something that is so obscure that people are going to vote no because they don't understand it?
Well, I think they were hoping that people would not spend any time reading it. And frankly... I think they did foul up on their end in getting their message out, but they didn't really have a message on one. One was anti-reform. It was to essentially gut a constitutional amendment that we passed in 2014. And, maybe when they're sitting around the halls of the state capitol trying to put one over the public might seem okay, but it's not okay when it actually ends up on the ballot. And then they have to figure out, well, who's going to actually want to go out there and defend this monstrosity, which is really designed through Daenerys to give an upper further upper hand in New York State to the Democratic Party. I mean, they were trying to make New York State into Venezuela as far as the electoral process is concerned. And that's just simply wrong, and they got caught. And the what's the punishment? The punishment is they're going to have to live under the law that the public passed in 2014. That doesn't seem to me to be, you know, something that was so far out of reach that they shouldn't have been doing that in the first place.
By the way, this is going to shock you. I agree with everything you just said. In other words, if you read Prop 1, you really got the idea that there was a poison pill in there which was going to help the party in power. I think you were right about that.
Well, let me talk to you about Prop 3 for a second, the 10-day elimination. So this is what we discovered as we were moving around the state. We were opposed, of course. Remember, it's people who are registered to vote that are going to vote for this. And the people who are registered to vote did not understand how one could not at least register to vote 10 days out. It almost seemed to a lot of people like there was something fishy about creating something where you could register and vote on Election Day, particularly with all the countless stories about issues with the Board of Elections securing ballots. You know, we just saw in New York City yesterday that there is that in a race in Brooklyn, they are the Board of Elections has caught several ballots from dead people on the paper. So people have a certain distrust anyways. It doesn't take a great amount of responsibility to register to vote once in your life. Just you only got to register once 10 days before an election, where, you know, you would hope that that gives the board at least some time, or authority some time, to check out whether this is a legitimate registration. Because sometimes, sometimes they're not.
Okay, let's go from there to the idea that Trump always talks about rigged elections. But he's been caught, for want of a better word, with his intellectual pants down, asking people to find votes to have him elected president, and asking for judgment that he was within his powers to do the kinds of things we've seen him do. I mean, I find that very disgusting. You're a conservative. You believe in the Constitution. And yet, This is a guy who wanted to destroy the Constitution, in my mind.
Well, he feels. This just so you let me give you just my view on the. I mean, I believe Biden won, but I also believe there were serious issues in at least some of the states like Pennsylvania. I can't say to you outright that I think the elections would have flipped on those states, but I can say to you that whether it be odd things that their state legislature did or questions in the Philadelphia area, which I just believe have some validity through my own experiences in politics. I mean, the president does take it to a greater step, obviously, I don't have an issue with him taking to it a greater step, but my own view is that that's pretty much, you know, it's pretty much done. That it is done in my view, that count, but I think it raised important questions that every legislative body and every government agency that manages elections in this country has to look more closely at. There are always questionable things that occur in elections, right? But we always have a responsibility to look back in and correct, not just so. When I say that election might be done in terms of who won, it doesn't mean that those questions don't need to be addressed. So maybe I deviate, Alan, from the president on where he's going, but I don't deviate with the president on the concept that there are things here that needed to be looked at.
But you are open to the idea that, you know, our politics have to be open, aren't you?
Yeah, transparency.
Yeah, well, this is a trick question, of course. So I want to know who paid for the ads you ran against the propositions.
So it's not a trick question. A lot of the money came in from Ron Lauder, who's been a constant and important supporter of the Conservative Party for going into the 1980s. So a lot of it came in from him. We, of course, in no way, shape, or form were ever doing anything other than, you know, planning to report. But the thing is, you know, I mean, we follow the law, and people ask me the question directly, and I give them an answer. He definitely was by far the major contributor to that. But, you know, the plan itself, executing, you know, give me the resources, and I'll give you a campaign. But I got to get the resources first, and in this particular case, I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how helpful he was. It's just very, very, very helpful. Now, we do raise money all year round. I mean, we have people contributing to us constantly. I mean, we're a political party. So, you know, I mean, I want to give you an answer to your question, but anyone who looks at our stuff will see that there's all sorts of people, countless people that are supporting the party with $25 or $2,500.
Gotcha. Okay, let's go to Buffalo. Progressives are angry after their self-described socialist candidate, India Walton, lost in the general election to Mayor Byron Brown, who ran as a write-in candidate after beating him in the primary. Progressives accused wealthy Democrats and even Republican donors from helping Brown. Now, you're a very seasoned political observer, so what would you say to that? I mean, can you give us some analysis as to what happened there? Why did a progressive win in the primary but get swamped later on?
I think Brown made a mistake in the primary and not really campaigning. He just thought that was going to line up, and his laziness cost him the primary. I mean, it was a fairly low turnout. It was focused on who she was pulling out. And then, of course, it became Save Our City. I was up in Buffalo a number of times in the last couple of months, a number of times, and I was interviewed on the race. I probably did Brown a disservice by telling people if I lived in the city of Buffalo, I'd vote for Brown, which I would have if I lived in the city. Because in the final analysis, it does come down to whether it be SOS, Save Our State, or SOC, Save Our City. Brown won re-election because people were extraordinarily concerned about where the city would go if she was elected mayor. And that really goes way beyond party labels.
Yeah. But what about our system where in a primary, one candidate wins and then gets swamped later on?
Well, I mean, it is the right. It was a write-in, so that even goes even further
sure.
to send the send Walton a message about what occurred here. Because they had an enormous hill to climb there, but you know the polling in that going back. So I mean the first polls that I think we saw on that race were like in early September, and I think from the first poll on she was losing by 30 points.
But she can still win a primary.
Well, right, and that does that. Look, that also happens a lot in New York City. I am no way, shape, or form going to suggest to you in many of these Democratic communities in New York City, you know, anybody other than a Democrat would win. But the turnout in the primary absolutely dictates, in normal cases, who the winner is going to be in November. You know, as in this particular case, it simply did not because so few people voted in that primary. In New York City, the primaries are often have more energy behind them, almost always, than the general elections. In this particular city, it didn't work out that way.
What do you know about the concept of the woke crowd? On your website, cpnys.org, you comment on the election saying there is hope. America gave the woke crowd a wake-up call. How do you define that?
I define them as individuals who really have very little interest in a dialogue on issues and have every interest in pushing a particular agenda all the time. I mean, I'm trying to suggest to you that the Conservative Party is interested in good government. I think the woke crowd is interested in their government. And that is, you know, that I'm not trying to be hypocritical here because I do push our agenda, obviously. But I saw this at City Hall with Mayor de Blasio and a crew of people over there. That one of the reasons the city was so badly managed was because they just simply wanted to put in place ideas that many citizens of the city did not have an interest in. Just give you an example here. I mean, I believe the city needed to have, to some degree, more bike lanes. But they've got bike lanes crisscrossing this city in areas where absolutely nobody uses them, and certainly nobody uses them for 4 or 5 months of the year. But you know what? The woke crowd said, we need bicycle lanes. The hell with cars. That's not what the people generally wanted. The same thing that's occurring when they're looking to do this this tolling project in Manhattan. There are 5 boroughs in the city. 4 boroughs oppose it. 1 borough and the woke crowd support it. We, fortunately, with these results, whether they be in Virginia, New Jersey, or victories on these propositions, Long Island, Nassau, Suffolk, they get at least a pushback. You know, it was at least for this cycle a sea of change. Politics has ebbs and flows, Alan, as you well know. We will see stuff go back the other way at some point, but right now they got pushed back, and that's good.
We're running out of time. Tish James is running for governor against, a lot of people, Hochul, others. Does she have a shot?
Yeah, because I think 78, going to your point earlier about primaries, I think 78% of the primary vote comes from, like, Orange, Rockland, down through Long Island, and I think she will. I think Governor Hochul will have a problem overcoming that. Obviously, there could be multiple candidates, but one of those candidates could be Swazi, who could actually be taking votes from Hochul. So I definitely think she has a shot at winning the primary. She definitely represents the woke crowd, and I think an examination of her, you know, incumbency as attorney general will prove my point.
Okay, so let me just ask you about one last thing, and then we're done. And that's assisted suicide. Are you for it?
No.
How come?
No, I'm not. And
I'm for it.
Well, what's, you know, I mean, then, you know, this is one of those issues which actually is not necessarily always Republican or conservative. Let me just add you. I'm not. I spent those years I worked in the legislature. I can't tell you the number of disability groups that came in and felt that this was the first step towards issues that they could later have with you know, the creation of a system that them at risk. Now, you might say, well, that's not true, but that is what how they felt. And I frankly bought into their arguments, and I also have a personal religious and moral objection to it. You know, but I spoke to many groups that, you know, that really had a concern of what this was going to be saying about American society.
We've been talking to Jerry Kosar, who is the chair of the Conservative Party in New York State. And Jerry, I always love talking to you. We're on polar opposites on many issues. Nevertheless, I love the fact that you come on and you say what you think. That's just great.
Well, I appreciate that, Alan.
I want to tell you how much I appreciate that. Okay. So we are out of time. Our guest has been Gerard Kosar, chairman of the New York State Conservative Party. Jerry, again, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.